You're listening to the Choose to Be podcast with hosts Alana Gordon and Amy Woolsey. As you join us each week, we will provide you with tools, resources, and knowledge to help you navigate your healing journey. Choose recovery, choose healing, choose you.
Welcome to the Choose to Be podcast. We are so glad you are tuning in today. We have a special guest, new friend and colleague that I'm excited to introduce. Hope Ray is with us today. And before I introduce her, I just want to invite those of you listening to put on your curiosity hat. We have some new information that, in my opinion, is groundbreaking in the world of psychology. And I know in the opinion of Hope and Alana as well. And as Hope puts it, it's creating a new branch in an old tree. And I am thrilled to have her here. And Alana and I fully recognize that her new terminology can be triggering and challenging for some to conceptualize. This might very well be an episode that you will listen to a few times. It's important, though, to Alana and I that we keep open minds as we're always learning from other professionals so that we as professionals can stay in that growth mindset to better support our clients. Hope Ray is a licensed professional counselor, certified sex addiction therapist, and a certified hope and freedom practitioner. Hope worked alongside Dr. Ken Adams, who you remember we had on our podcast not too long ago. Hope is the pioneer of betrayal violence, and in 2023, Hope established the Betrayal Violence Institute, which provides definitions and education for mental health professionals, legal systems, faith-based organizations, and general society to embrace in an effort to distinguish the conduct of betrayal violence from other forms of betrayal trauma and domestic abuse. You can find out more about that. Again, the link will be in the show notes, but going to betrayalviolenceinstitute.com. And her new publication, Complex Partner Trauma Magazine, is amazing, and I think y'all should get it. We'll have the link to that in the show notes. Here is our conversation with Hope Ray. Enjoy. Well, thank you again for taking time. I know you're very busy. So thanks for taking time to meet with us. And I personally am just so grateful that you and I met Hope and that Alana introduced us. And it was funny. I remember at the ITAP symposium, she's like, you, friends. Like, get together. Like, you need to. And then she just like walked away and you and I were just like,
I remember. And that was our launch point. And here we are.
Yep. So I love it. So honored to know you and very, very grateful that you gifted me this magazine, which will be in the show notes for everybody to get. And I just want to start off actually by saying, yeah, if you're on YouTube, Alana just held it up. Complex Partner Trauma, issue number one, because there's going to be many issues to come. But I do want to just start by saying, there's no way we're going to cover everything around this topic in this episode. And I cannot stress enough as someone who is like, I sent a picture to Hope. I'm like, it's falling apart. I bought another one yesterday. Like, my pages are everywhere because I have gone through this so much. And I encourage all of you to get the magazine to read through all of the definitions that Hope has created new terminology for. Definitions that more specifically give a language to what this experience of betrayal violence is. Hope's created a landing page of the Betrayal Violence Institute. So betrayalviolenceinstitute.com. So go check that out because, again, that's the hub of all of these beautiful definitions. And like you said, the mission to just really provide that research and terminology to help with understanding the experiences that women have. And I think that's why for me, I was telling Alana this morning, why for me, Hope, reading this information, reading about betrayal violence, understanding this new terminology and how you've defined it and the model that you've created around it was yet another piece to my story, another way to define and give language to my story. And when I read through this, my body accepted it so quickly. It's taken me a while to conceptualize because your brain is just way smarter than mine. And so I'm like trying to understand like how this all fits together, like cognitively. But I just have to say, like, my body accepted it
very quickly because I lived this experience. So thank you. I really just want to start off by thank you for your work. I know this has been blood, sweat, and tears. But let's go ahead and just start off with your definition, you defining betrayal violence.
Awesome. Well, thank you for such a generous introduction and the friendship we have here and the torch we're carrying forward together and many of our other colleagues too. It is so exciting to me because I think it's really time to define. That's the hashtag I use, time to define betrayal violence. And why are we doing this? Are we trying to pathologize and make things scarier and harder and worse? No, we're actually trying to bring clarity. We're trying to help people understand what needs to be healed so that more relationships can heal. And I think when we look at the conduct of deception and persuasion and exploitation, when we look at the conduct versus trying to define a diagnosis for the person doing that conduct, I think then we remove the centering from the person who's doing the betraying and we put it on the relationship, and it helps us clearly define the dynamics that are at play when this type of power and control is used to keep a secret life hidden. So betrayal violence is about conduct, and that conduct has three parts. When somebody is maintaining a relationship with their significant other while secretly and repeatedly violating fidelity, and then using abusive behavior and communication to avoid the consequences, therefore restraining their partner from knowing essential information about the partner's safety and well-being. Therefore, the partner can't accurately assess his or her reality because this essential information is being withheld. And sometimes partners do have some pieces of information, but they very often for months or years don't have the whole picture. And so they can't make appropriate decisions for their bonding with their partner or for whether or not they are safe to be intimate with their partners or if they should stay or they should go. They can't accurately assess those things because they have pieces of a puzzle that don't portray the full picture. And so they react accordingly. We react with the amount of information we have. And so the problem here, the use of power and control here, is about controlling your partner's reality, withholding information from them, or even persuading them to believe that they're safe to continue bonding and participating in the relationship as if all is normal when it's not. And so betrayal violence is a form of conduct with three parts, and it leads to a lot of detriment in the relationship. And for the betrayed partner, oftentimes we see these really post-traumatic stress-related symptoms. I call it complex partner trauma. I believe it's a very specific experience when you've been betrayed by your intimate partner in these deeply intimate ways, when your intimate reality has been withheld from you. And I think it's a specific experience because when partners are in the dark, they continue bonding in ways they would not have otherwise if they had known what they needed to know.
That's the part that just gets me, right, Alana? Like, oh, just even hearing you say that, and every time I even think about it, that's the part that just, to me, why the word violence is appropriate.
And here's something, too, that society really needs to be able to understand. First of all, a more thorough definition of the word violence, because most people think black eyes and bruises, and there's actually a much broader way to look at violence, a healthier, more thorough way. And the other thing that society really could benefit from understanding is this is why partners stay and experience so much ambivalence. So it's easy from the outside to say, whoa, you've been cheated on, or whoa, he lied to you about these affairs or about that years-long pornography habit. What are you still doing with him? Why haven't you left? And what they don't understand is the partner adaptive bonding cycle, the way in which we as partners continue to bond in the midst of unsafe circumstances because we don't have an accurate picture of our own endangerment. And endangerment really has to do with the idea that there are secrets that really matter for us to know, and we don't know about them.
Can you tell me more about, you said, this is so good, a more thorough way to look at the word violence. because I know so many people have emotional reactions around the word violence and around the word abuse. And so some women probably skipped over this episode altogether because they went, ooh, violence. No, I don't have that. I don't want to look at that. That's not me. And I'm hoping that they don't. But can you break down that word even more? Because I don't want it to be a scary word. I think that the way you're describing it is accurate. And what do you do with the betrayed partners or even professionals who are really uncomfortable with the word violence or abuse?
Well, the first thing I want to share with folks who feel it's such a strong word, which it is, that this is how we depathologize the problem. When we continue to focus on cheaters and liars as with these diagnostic terms, as if any singular diagnosis would fit this type of person or personality, it isn't a diagnosis. It isn't a personality type. Anyone really can cross into the threshold of betrayal violence when they're doing those three things: maintaining a relationship while secretly and repeatedly violating fidelity, and then trying to cover it up, which ends up being a bunch of subterfuge and deception. So the first thing I really want to tell people is this is how we take it off of the person and their personality and their character, and we look at what they're doing. Because when we look at what they're doing, regardless of whatever mental health issues they may have or personality disorders they may have, when we look at what they're doing, we're able to say, okay, here's the definition of the behavior, and therefore we can take a look at really targeting treatment on those behaviors. And if treatment then works, then perhaps this person can not relapse back into this mode. So I think it's a strong word, violence, but it also is the best way to approach this, especially because the word violence is pretty accurate here. Violence, in a more thorough understanding, involves knowing that there's different types of violence. There is interpersonal violence between people. There's cultural violence. There's self-directed violence or self-harm. And violence in a physical manner is something we all understand. We think about intentional violence, where somebody uses a gun to harm someone or uses their fist. But what we also know is that really anything that can cause psychological harm and deprivation of someone's rights or access to resources, anything that can cause maldevelopment, it really can be considered violence. And here's the thing that's so difficult, I think, as we talk about this. Violence can occur even when it's not intended. I mean, a really morbid and sad example would be to think about children who are playing with some sort of weapon and a death results from that. Was that intentional? The answer would be no. And the idea is violence has still occurred. Now, that's a physical form of violence. But in relation to folks who are, you know, in this conduct of betrayal violence, very often they are working so hard to avoid the consequences of their secret behavior. And one of those consequences very often is that they don't want their partner to know about this because of the damage they know it would cause. But there's selfish reasons too. And that is a relatively selfish reason, by the way, because to try and control your partner's reality, thinking it's noble to prevent the pain. So, you know, it just becomes important to know that violence isn't always intended. Like, there is ways to actualize violence, especially with folks who are betraying and trying to avoid those consequences. And they're essentially not wanting to deal with the aftermath of their behavior. And they're wanting to, it's a have your cake and eat it too scenario. And so when that happens, these abusive behaviors, deception, persuasion or thought control, really trying to control someone's understanding of their internal and external experience. And furthermore, the exploitation that also unfolds here is just the byproduct of keeping a secret life. And so when you look at the maladaptive way in which these people are going about trying to keep their secrets, you find that there's great psychological harm that results from that, lots of trauma very often for the partner, a deprivation of the ability to consent to important things like whether or not my body feels safe to be sexual with this person who may not be disclosing to me the risk of STIs, right? And even maldevelopment of the family system or of the relationship. There's just a lot of harm that comes from secret keeping. And so even when somebody's not trying to cause that harm or trying to be violent, it can occur nonetheless. So the intention that matters is the use of power and control, not the intention to harm. The intention that matters is I'm using the power and control that I have to manipulate the reality of the other person.
Okay, I want to slow this down for our listeners because I was trying to flip through the magazine really quick and find the part. But when I was reading you talking about that intentionality in the magazine, I was like, oh, finally someone's talking about this piece of it. Because yes, there are some who are using power and control and are very aware of it. And in classic IPV, interpersonal violence research, a lot of people will say, well, they know they're doing it. And what I was seeing as a professional was so many of my clients weren't seeing that they were doing it. And it often would come out later. The partner who had been being trained all of a sudden would go, oh, I have been manipulating them. I couldn't see that. I didn't see that. And it was until they got far enough in their work that they were able to uncover their own layers of denial, and their own understanding started to bloom. And so I see like on both sides, and I think this intentionality where when often it comes from this place of maladaptive self-protection, it makes so much sense to me that it's not intended and they don't get a free pass when it's not intended, because the impact of the IPV that, or not IPV, of the betrayal violence that you're talking about is still there. So we still have to address that. But it does make a difference if we're dealing with somebody who is intentionally trying to gaslight you, manipulate you, and alter your reality, and they're thinking about that. And if they're doing it as part of their own patterns of trying to hide where they're at. And my question for you is it important that betrayed partners know which they're dealing with?
Absolutely. Yes, because we can't keep lumping all abusers into the same lump. There is different kinds of abuse. So we talked about the different kinds of violence, right? When we look at interpersonal violence, one of those forms would be domestic violence. And domestic violence, the way the Netherlands defines that, is anything that happens within the domestic system. So this could even be elder abuse or child abuse, but often intimate partner violence would fall under that, right? And so when we look at intimate partner violence, that would be the use of lots of similar methods like deception, persuasion, exploitation, but also often physical or verbal assault or aggression. And that use of power and control is geared around something different than the use of power and control in betrayal violence. In intimate partner violence, the person who is abusing is working to establish dominance over the other person, working to sway that person into their methodology, into their way of thinking, reducing their autonomy, cutting them off from resources, isolating them often is a part of intimate partner violence. And those intentions are to use power and control intentionally for an outcome of diminishing a partner. It's a different experience than betrayal violence all by itself. But here's the thing. People can experience multiple forms of domestic abuse at the same time. So I've had many clients who are partnered with somebody who narcissistically abuses them or physically abuses them or uses all sorts of verbal aggression and abuse, which would be intimate partner violence, coupled with then all the cheating and deception there. That's experiencing two forms of domestic abuse at the same time. And so I think it's important to not say that all abusers are the same. What we also want to be careful of is saying some abuse is better than other abuse. That's not true either. But abuse is abuse. And when people are abusing, harmful aftermath occurs. But there is different kinds of abuse. And the reason it's important to understand that is because so many women who've been betrayed or men who've been betrayed are trying to evaluate if they should leave. And what's one of the biggest questions they're asking? is he or she capable of change? I see good changes, but will they last? Is this person still trying to just manipulate me or not? And then you get on TikTok or you read articles where people lump all abusers into one category and say they can't change. Once an abuser, always an abuser. Once a cheater, always a cheater. And the truth is that for somebody who is really trying to subdue their partner and degrade that person's worth and value in order to feel better about themselves, that may be less of a changeable behavior than somebody who is operating out of secrecy and an evasive use of power and control. Again, it's no better. It's still full-blown abuse. I'm calling it violence, right? But at the end of the day, there is a different ability maybe for change in that regard. But then again, if you have somebody who's doing both betrayal violence and intimate partner violence, maybe the rehabilitation potential is affected by the duality there and the amount of issues the person is facing that lead them to use power and control in that way.
So one thing that's coming up for me too, that Alana and I've had conversation around with your work, Hope, is the term betrayal violence versus the term betrayal trauma. And can you explain the difference and how we use both of those terms and how both terms still exist and matter?
Yeah, I love the term betrayal trauma. That's Jennifer Fried's work. I think most people who've been betrayed and have been finding resources over the past 10 years have heard her name by now. What she did is created a theory that allows us to take a look at two types of betrayal. One is interpersonal betrayal trauma, and the other would be institutional betrayal trauma. Like, for instance, if you're betrayed by your college sports program where there was abuse that took place when your well-being and safety were trampled on by a college program, that would be an example of institutional betrayal trauma. Interpersonal betrayal trauma has to do with relying on someone, depending on them, having a close attachment to them in order that has been exploited, wherein you've experienced betrayal. And it used to be in her theory that this was really about children and their caregivers, because children depend on caregivers in a much different way than, say, intimate partners depend on each other. But she has expanded to create an umbrella term for interpersonal betrayal trauma that says, hey, this can happen in marriages and in intimate relationships and even between siblings or adult children. Say there's an elderly person whose adult children are their caregivers and they are actively experiencing betrayal from their adult children in this vulnerable position. So what I like to say about betrayal trauma is that it's an incredibly important contribution to psychology because it helps us to understand the nature of attachment and relying on someone who then proves to be untrustworthy or worse, right? But we also have kind of monopolized the term betrayal trauma in this area of infidelity, meaning that when you Google betrayal trauma, you'll find a bulk of information around sex addiction and infidelity betrayal. And so we've maybe stolen a little bit from other populations that deserve to claim the experience of betrayal trauma, but it still fits. This, you know, this type of experience is absolutely a form of betrayal trauma. What I'm seeking to do is not necessarily move out from under that umbrella. I think it still applies, but also what applies is the umbrella of domestic violence. Because when we look at the conduct that betrayed partners are suffering from, that's where we see that there's issues of domestic violence at play. And so I think we're just looking at how does this fit with other disciplines? How does this relate to other areas in the field of psychology?
It's really interesting because Amy and I were talking this morning. She's so funny because we will show up to record and then we'll just chit chat the whole time and never record. So sometimes she'll call me an hour early while I'm getting ready so we get all of our talking out. So we had one of those this morning of just talking, and we were talking about how some professionals are having a hard time kind of wrapping their head around this concept. And Amy in particular has really embraced it. So we were playing with why. And one thing that both of us were talking about is some professionals can feel really threatened by this idea because it's almost like what they have built a lot of their understanding, their careers around is this idea of vitreal trauma or this term of vitreal trauma. And then all of a sudden it's, oh no, I have to throw that away and you want me to use this instead. And so I love that you asked this question, Amy, because what I'm hearing is no, they can still, they can both apply. And what I'm trying to do with my work and Clean This Up Help, but what I'm trying to do with my work is really give even more clarity. Let's dive deeper into what is really happening so we can do even better work. And so there's no need to have this threatening or this competition. It's more of let's give more understanding and tools and resources so we can better treat. And that to me, if you look at like even her initial definition of where betrayal trauma started to where the research is and understanding is like in the last decade of where we've come. And I'm just reading right now, Michelle May's new book. And Michelle brings in a ton of attachment in the betrayal bind. And I was like, ooh, I love your work, Michelle, but we will keep evolving as professionals. And the minute we don't, that's problematic. And so I love where you're coming in and you're giving more perspective, more fresh ideas. And I think it's really healthy and really important that all of us, whether we're betrayed partners or whether we're professionals, are always in a mindset of growth. So that's just my little soapbox. But yeah, I would love your thoughts on that, Hope.
Well, and I appreciate that. I think that our field is relatively young. The idea of sexual betrayal being a problem is young. The idea of compulsive or addictive sexual behavior, we're looking at maybe about 40 years or so into the field. And that's young because there's a lot yet to keep building on. The thing is that betrayal violence, I believe, is something that many people have already embraced, whether or not they like the terminology or feel comfortable with it yet. So many of our colleagues are already treating more than just the sexual problem that led to the betrayal. They're also in their programs treating the deception and all the gaslighting and all of the manipulation that comes with it. And so when marriages are healing, and there are many marriages and relationships that are healing after all of this, it's because not only is the sexual problem being addressed with recovery and sobriety, essentially, but also the relationship dynamics that unfolded where there was a power differential and a deference of knowledge between the partners that gets dissolved and rehabilitated. But here's the thing, both of those behavioral issues can relapse. You can not only just relapse in your sexual problem and go back to those behaviors, you can also relapse in your secret keeping. And you can relapse, if you're relapsing here, you're most likely going to relapse here. But sometimes there's no sexual activity or relapse, and there's still perpetuating of power and control that involves entitlement or lack of empathy, lack of shouldering the burden of the pain that they caused, or taking full responsibility, rushing the partner to hurry up and forgive or move on, expecting the trust of the partner to be commensurate with all the hard work they've done in their sexual recovery, but not understanding the skills they need to build over here. And this is another reason why I don't like lumping all abusers into one lump, because very often when somebody, let's say it's a person who identifies as a sex addict, and let's say it's a he and he's doing really well in his recovery, but his partner is saying, I don't believe he's acting out, but I don't feel like he's changing. I don't feel like he is getting me or getting what he's done. And frankly, this marriage is not really ironing out to be worth all that I went through. I want something better than what we had before. And then that person starts questioning, is he capable of the real change that will create the intimacy and connection that I need and desire? And so if at that point they're feeling like, well, I've heard that all abusers really don't change then they might shortchange themselves from a process that could possibly be rehabilitated. What's often missing is that people who betray don't realize they need to address the maladaptive character traits that had them deceiving and persuading and exploiting their partner. And so they're going without understanding of that. I call it an insufficient realization. And therefore, they're going without skill sets that they really need in order to produce empathy and honesty and integrity, reliability, all these things that make them feel better and give their partner more hope that the marriage can get to a place that transcends where it was before. So I agree that there are clinicians who are going to find this difficult. The word violence is a strong word. And again, until we have a more thorough understanding of it, people may say, no, that's not violence. But this is probably how it was when domestic violence became a thing. I'm probably too young for that. I think we all are, because that was years and years ago as it started gaining momentum. You can't hit your wife. You can't beat her with a stick. That rule of thumb situation was a big deal where people were saying that you hit your wife with a stick as thick as your thumb, but no more. And the idea is that would have been met with resistance too. And so I think it's going to take time. I believe this material will outlive me and hopefully grow into a place where modern society can embrace it. But who knows how long that will take.
Okay. Sorry. Go ahead, Alana.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm looking at the time and I have all these topics that I'm like, I still want to ask about this. I want to ask about this. I want to ask about this. So I just am going to plug Hope. Please come back for part two or part three or part four, because there's so many pieces of this, tangible pieces that I want to give to partners and those who have betrayed who are trying to understand. I would love to give them tangible pieces. And so with the time left, Amy, if you have a really clean this up after, but if you have something more you want to tackle, Amy, cool. But if you don't, I would love maybe just something for partners listening, some things that they can do something with. And I don't even know what, because my brain is going to all different areas, because I know entitlement is a huge piece. Wanting that empathy is a huge piece.
Yeah.
What are they looking for? I mean, you could talk about where they have been. Like, there's just so many different roads we could take.
Right. Well, let me first say that as partners explore the topic of betrayal violence, it can be difficult because when they start to resonate with the behaviors that were enacted against them, they start to begin a really deep despair that, wow, I was abused in this way. I knew it was bad, but I guess I didn't really have words to put to it. That's a common experience that I'm running into. And so people need support as they're exploring this. But I guess there's some hope in that because for the people who've caused the betrayal, they're open to this concept I'm finding because it helps them understand what their partner has been trying to translate to them all along. And it gives words to what needs to change. It's not just the sexual behavior. That's not going to be enough to restore the relationship. What's going to cause the relationship to get better is dissolving the power differential and inversing these maladaptive character traits of entitlement and regression and incongruence, these ways and methods in which somebody continues avoiding consequences, avoiding responsibility, living below their potential, exploiting their partner, deceiving their partner, getting away with things that are not really within their own value system. And so I think it's really helpful for people to be able to say, hey, I'm a betrayed partner, and now I know what kind of sexual recovery is important. And now I also know what kind of rehabilitation is important as far as the power differential goes and the ways in which I was abused by the subterfuge and the deception of my partner. And so what I can do is explain my need for my partner to explore this area and acquire the skill necessary to inverse those maladaptive character traits and address the abuse piece. And once I believe that my partner has sufficient information there and has had access to the resources he or she needs to make positive skill development and change, then at that point, I can really sit back and observe, okay, my partner has what they need. Are they doing it? And that's where willingness really comes in. Very often, people are willing to change. They just don't know what it is that they need to do because they're so focused more on the sexual piece and less on the abuse piece. And this is where it gets tricky, because sometimes marriages or relationships end up getting ruined because there isn't a development of the essential skills here to fix the abuse piece. And sometimes it doesn't have to be that way, but sometimes it does, because willingness is a real thing. And when somebody has what they need and understands what they need to know and still remains entitled and deceptive and abusive, well, then that gives you the information you need to know about that person's willingness to really do what it takes.
Right. So how I'm looking at this more tangibly, what you just said there, Hope, is, and what I love about the language is that this is giving an opportunity not only for the betrayed partner to understand better, and I'm going to genderize here, her lived experience. Oh, this is what's happening to me. This is what I've experienced. And it gives the betrayer an opportunity to get into her story and to understand what her experience is. And I think that's a huge piece. I know a lot of times when, like, Alana and I are doing disclosures, that's her opportunity to hear his story. But the part of the disclosure that often gets overlooked is the impact letter, right? And I think, like, here's the impact. Here's what your behavior and betrayal violence, right? What I'm experiencing, here's how this has impacted me. And I think this language helps that betrayer understand her lived experience and how his behaviors impacted her. And so, again, anytime we can better define that experience, that lived experience, I embrace. And that's why I said in the beginning, like, my body accepted this, and it just gave more definition, more beautiful language to my lived experience. And I encourage those who might be pushing back on this a little bit, get the magazine, read through it. And those who, we do have listeners here that are the betrayer, I want to encourage you and invite you to get into this as well and see how your actions are creating her lived experience. And that is such a beautiful part of that healing pyramid, right? Of all of the truth, all of the honesty. And part of that is being honest with yourself and how your actions have impacted your partner. And your work just gives a beautiful language to that impact.
Thank you. I am so thankful for the support of this material from both of you, the friendship, and also the ability to use your platform to help spread the message, because it does feel very timely. I do believe it's time to define this stuff. And you're right in what you said, Amy, that it helps people who've betrayed to understand their partner's experience, but it also gives them a piece of their own life back. Very often when we're operating in a place of incongruency, a hidden place of a secret life, these things that unfold from there, these maladaptive character traits, the deception, abuse of behavior, is so often not congruent with who they actually want to be. Now, in some cases, that is who the person is. But in many cases, that person finds themselves in a place of breach. I'm acting like my dad, or I'm doing the things that I never thought I would do, or this doesn't align with my faith. And when they're able to not just see themselves on paper according to very specific conduct, it allows them to say, okay, so that's what I'm doing. And this is what she's been trying to tell me all along, by the way. And now I can solve the problem because I know we've identified what it is. And so that's part of my mission, is to create the framework then and to promote what I've found that helps people actually rehabilitate from that behavior for good.
Yeah, I love it.
It's exciting work.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Hope. Thank you for sharing your work with us. Definitely, there's so many more levels and layers to this that I think would be great to just dive through. And Amy and I have always been ones where we don't want to avoid the real and avoid the hard, because in the real and the hard, that's where the true healing happens. And so excited about your work. Well, thank you for joining us today if you want more about Hope Raise work. And as always, thanks for hanging out with us today. And we look forward to seeing you all next week.
Bye, everybody.
Gaining more awareness and understanding to your lived experience and seeing things as they really are is a part of the healing journey. The Relationship Dynamic Assessment created by Kimberly Day is a tool that's available to those who are wanting to better discern what those unhealthy dynamics are in their relationship. I offer the assessment with a one-on-one 90-minute session to go over the results with you. Head over to Choose Recovery Services to find out how you can take this extremely informative assessment that, as I have found, saves lots of time trying to put these pieces together. We are here to support you in your journey to choosing recovery, choosing to heal, and choosing you. Take care, everybody.